asked me if I wanted anything, like a burger or anything. He said he'd buy me whatever I wanted if I just eat it with him. Like, just sit at the table with him. I knew he was a fag, but if he wanted to buy me a Big Mac, what did I care? I know I'm not gay, so what does it matter to me? So I said, okay, and we're eating, and he's trying to be all beast, like he's this cool dude, like he's my buddy, and he asks me if I want to come see his apartment. He says he's got a bunch of DVDs there and we can watch a movie or whatever. So I knew what he was after. So I told him straight up I wasn't going to do anything with him, but if he had some money, maybe we could work something out. So he says he'll give me $50 if he can, like, touch my package or whatever, like over my pants. I told him he could do it if he gave me $100. So he did. He gave you $100? Yeah, just like to touch my ass and stuff. The kid snorted at the price he had extorted for such a small thing. Go on. So after that, he kept saying he wanted to keep doing it. So he'd give me $100 every time. And what did you do for him? Nothing, I swear. Come on, Matt, $100? Really, all I ever did was let him touch my ass and, like, my front. Did you take anything off? No, my clothes were on the whole time. Every time? Every time. How many times were there? Five. $500? That's right. The kid sniggered again. Easy money. Did he reach inside your pants? Hesitation. Once. Once? Really, once. How long did this go on? A few weeks. He said it was all he could afford. So what happened at the library? Nothing. I've never even been to the library. I don't even know where it is. So why'd you report him? He said he didn't want to pay me anymore. He said he didn't like paying. He shouldn't have to pay if we were like friends. I told him if he didn't pay me, I'd report him. I knew he was on probation. I knew he was on the sex offender list. If he got violated on his probation, he was going away. Even he knew that. And he wouldn't pay? He paid some. He comes to me all like, I'll pay you half. So I told him, you'll pay me all. He had it. He's got lots of it. Anyway, it wasn't like I wanted to, but I need money, you know? I mean, look at this place. You know what it's like to have no money? It's like you can't do anything. So you were shaking him down for money. So what? What's this got to do with Cold Spring Park? That was his whole reason, like, for dropping me. He said there was this other kid he liked, some kid who walked through the park in the morning near his apartment. What kid? The one who got killed. How do you know it's the same kid? 'Cause Leonard said he was going to try and meet him. He was, like, scouting him out. Like, walking through the park in the morning trying to meet him. He even knew the kid's name. He heard his friend say it. It was Ben. He said he was going to try to talk to him. This was all before it happened, he's saying these things. I didn't even think anything about it until the kid got killed. What did Leonard say about him? He said he was beautiful. That was the word he used, beautiful. What makes you think he could be violent? Did he ever threaten you? No, are you kidding? I'd fuck him up. That's just it. Lenny's kind of a pussy. And that's why he likes kids, I think, because he's a big guy, but he figures kids are smaller. So why would he be violent with Ben Rifkin if he met him in the park? I don't know. I wasn't there. But I know Lenny had a knife and he took it with him when he thought he might be meeting people because he said sometimes, you know, if you're like a fag and you go up to the wrong guy, it can be bad. You saw the knife? Yeah, he had it with him the day I met him. What did it look like? Just, I don't know, it was a knife. Like a kitchen knife? No, more like a fighting knife, I guess. It had, like, teeth. I almost took it from him. It was pretty cool. Why didn't you ever tell anyone about this? You knew that kid got murdered. I'm on probation, too. I couldn't really tell anyone I was, like, getting money out of him or, like, that I lied about him grabbing me in the library. That's like a crime. Stop saying like. It's not like a crime. It is a crime. Right, exactly. Matt, how long were you going to go before you told anyone this? Were you going to let my son get convicted of a murder he didn't commit, just so you wouldn't have to be embarrassed you were letting some guy grab your nuts every week? Were you going to just keep your mouth shut while they sent my son off to Walpole? The kid did not answer. The anger I felt was of an old familiar kind now. A simple, righteous, soothing anger I knew like an old friend. I was not angry at this smart-ass punk. Life tends to punish fools like Matt McGrath anyway, sooner or later. No, I was angry at Pats himself, because he was a murderer. And the worst kind of murderer, a child murderer, a category for which cops and prosecutors reserve a special contempt. I figured no one would believe me, because my whole problem was, like, I couldn't tell about the kid that got killed because I already lied about the thing in the library. So if I told the truth, they were just going to say, wow, you already lied once, why should we believe you now? So what would be the point? He was right, of course. Matt McGrath was about as bad a witness as you could dream up. An admitted liar, no jury would ever trust him. The only trouble was, like the boy who cried wolf, he happened to be telling the truth this time. Chapter 17. Nothing's Wrong with Me. Facebook froze Jacob's account, probably because of a subpoena compelling the production of everything he had ever posted. But with suicidal persistence, he opened a new Facebook account under the name Marvin Glasscock and began friending his inner circle again. He made no secret of this, and I roared about it. To my surprise, Lori took Jacob's side. He's all alone, she said. He needs people. Everything Lori did, everything she ever did, was to help her son. She insisted that Jacob was completely isolated now, and his online life was such a necessary, integral, natural part of how kids socialize that it would be cruel to deny him even this minimal human contact. I reminded her that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts intended to deprive him of a hell of a lot more than that, and we agreed at least to place some limits on the new account. Jacob was not to change the password, which would deny us access and the ability to edit him. He was not to post anything that touched on the case even remotely. And he was strictly forbidden to post photos or video, which were impossible to keep from squirting around the internet once they got loose and which could easily be misconstrued. Thus began a cat-and-mouse game in which an otherwise intelligent child endeavored to make jokes about his own situation in terms just vague enough that his father would not censor what he wrote. I made it a part of my morning rounds on the internet to check what Marvin Glasscock had written on Facebook the night before. Every morning, first stop Gmail, second Facebook, then Google Jacob Barber for news of the case. Then, if all was clear, I would disappear down the rabbit hole of the internet for a few minutes to forget the raging shitstorm I was standing in. What I found most amazing about my son's reincarnation on Facebook was that anyone was willing to friend him at all. In the real world, he had no friends. He was now utterly alone. No one ever called him or visited. He had been suspended from school, and come September, the town would be obliged to hire a tutor for him. The law required it. Lori had been negotiating with the school department for weeks, haggling over how much in-home tutoring Jacob was entitled to. In the meantime, he seemed to be utterly friendless. The same kids who were willing to link to Jacob online refused to acknowledge him in person. Granted, there were only a handful who accepted Marvin Glasscock into their online circle. Before the Rifkin murder, Jacob's Facebook network, the number of kids who read Jacob's dashed-off comments and whose comments Jacob followed in turn, numbered 474, mostly classmates, mostly kids I had never heard of. After the murder, he had only four, one of whom was Derek Yu. I wonder if those four, or Jacob, ever quite understood that their every move online created a record. Every keyboard click was recorded and stored on a server somewhere. Nothing they did on the web, nothing, was private. And unlike a phone call, this was a written form of communication. They were generating a transcript of every conversation. The web is a prosecutor's fantasy, a monitoring and recording device that hears the most intimate, lurid secrets, even those never spoken out loud. It is better than a wire. It is a wire planted inside everyone's head. It was a matter of time, of course. Sooner or later, typing into his laptop late one night in the stoned-out bliss of web surfing, Jacob would make a dumb-shit teenage slip-up. It finally came in mid-August. Early on a Sunday morning, I glanced at Marvin Glasscock's Facebook page to find an image of Anthony Perkins in Psycho, the famous silhouetted figure with a knife raised over his shoulder to stab Janet Leigh in the shower, now with Jacob's face photoshopped onto it. Jacob as Norman Bates. The face was clipped from a snapshot of Jacob, apparently at a party. It showed Jacob grinning. Jacob had posted the mashup photo with the caption, "What people think of me." His friends responded with these comments. "Dude looks like a lady." "Awesome job. You should make this your new profile pic." "Wee, wee, wee," psycho music. "Marvin Glasscock, dude comes in with a total face melter." I did not immediately delete the photo. I wanted to confront Jacob with it. I carried the laptop upstairs with me, the machine humming in my hand. He was in his room, still asleep. One of his young adult novels lay open, pages down, on the night table. These were invariably futuristic science fiction or military fantasies about ultra-secret army units with names like Alpha Force. No broody teen vampires for Jacob, not escapist enough. It was around 7. The shades were down. The light in the room was muted. As I tromped barefoot to the side of his bed, Jacob woke up and twisted to look at me. No doubt I was scowling. I turned the computer around to show the screen to him, the evidence of his crime. "What is this?" He groaned, not quite awake. "What is this?"
"What?"
"This."
"I don't know. What are you talking about?"
"This picture on Facebook from last night. Did you put this up?"
"It's a joke."
"A joke?"
"It's just a joke, Dad."
"A joke? What's wrong with you?"
"Do we have to make a big deal,
Jacob? Do you know what they're going to do with this picture? They're going to wave it around in front of the jury, and do you know what they're going to say? They're going to say it shows consciousness of guilt. That's just the phrase they'll use, consciousness of guilt. They'll say, this is how Jacob Barber sees himself, psycho. When he looks in the mirror, this is the reflection he sees, Norman Bates. They'll use the word psycho over and over, and they'll hold this picture up, and the jury will stare at it. They'll stare at it, and guess what? They'll never be able to forget it. They'll never be able to quite get it out of their minds. It'll stick in their heads. It'll affect them. It'll twist them. It'll stain them. Maybe not all of them, maybe not much, but it will move the needle just a little further against you. That's how it works. That's what you did with this. You gave them a gift. A gift. For no good reason. If LeJudas finds this, it will never go away. Don't you get that? Don't you know what's at stake, Jacob?"
"Yes."
"Do you know what they want to do to you?"
"Of course I do."
"Then why? Tell me. Because it doesn't make any sense. Why would you do this?"
"I already told you it was a joke. It means the opposite of what you're saying. It's how other people see me. It's not how I see myself. It's not even about me."
"Oh, well, that's perfectly reasonable. You were just being clever and ironic. And, of course, the DA and the jury, they'll all understand that, too." "Jesus, are you stupid?"
"I'm not stupid. Then what's wrong with you?"
Lori's voice behind me.
"Andy, enough."
Her arms were crossed, eyes still sleepy. Jacob said mournfully,
"Nothing's wrong with me."
"Then what possessed you to—"
"Andy, stop."
"Why, Jacob? Just tell me why." My anger had peaked. Still, I was feeling wild enough to spray a few bullets Lori's way, too. "Can I ask him that? Can I ask him why, or is that too much?"
"It was just a joke, Dad. Can we just delete it?"
"No, we can't just delete it. That's the whole point. It doesn't go away, Jacob. We can delete it, but it doesn't go away. When your buddy Derek goes to the DA and tells him you have a Facebook account named Melvin Glasscock or whatever, and you put this picture up, all the DA has to do is send them a subpoena and he gets it. Facebook will just give it to him, all of it. This stuff sticks to you. It's like napalm. You can't do this. You can't do it."
"Okay.
You can't do stuff like this. Not now."
"Okay," I said. "Sorry."
"Don't be sorry. Sorry won't fix the problem."
"Andy, stop already. You're scaring me. What do you want him to do? It's done. He said he's sorry. What do you keep haranguing him for?"
"I keep haranguing him because it's important."
"It's done. He made a mistake. He's a kid. Please calm down, Andy. Please."
She came across the room, took the laptop from my hands. I was barely aware I was still holding it. And she examined the photo closely. She held the laptop with one hand on each edge, like a cafeteria tray.
All right, she shrugged. So let's just delete it and be done with it. How do I delete it? I don't see a button.
I took the laptop and searched the screen.
I don't see it either. Jacob, how do you delete this thing?
He took the laptop, and now seated on the edge of his bed, he clicked it a few times.
There, gone.
He closed the lid, handed it to me, then lay down and rolled over, turning his back to me. Lori gave me a look like I was the crazy one.
I'm going back to bed, Andy.
She padded out of the room, then I heard our bed rustle as she climbed back into it. Lori had always been an early riser, even on Sundays, until this happened to us. I stood there a moment, the laptop by my side now, held at my hip like a closed book.
I'm sorry, I yelled.
Jacob sniffed. I could not tell what that sniff signaled, whether he was near tears or angry with me. But it struck something in me and made me sentimental. I remembered baby Jake, our little precious, beautiful, blonde, wide-eyed baby. That this boy, this child man, was one and the same person as that baby, it came to me like a new idea, something I had never known. The baby did not become the boy. The baby was the boy, the same creature, unchanged at the core. This was the very baby I had held in my arms.
I sat down on the bed beside him and laid my hand on his bare shoulder.
I'm sorry, I yelled. I shouldn't lose my temper. I'm just trying to look out for you. You know that, don't you?
I'm going back to sleep.
Okay.
Just leave me alone.
Okay.
Okay, so go away.
I nodded, rubbed his shoulder a few times as if I could press the thought into him through his skin. I love you. But he lay there like a stone, and I stood up to leave.
The shape in the bed said, "There's nothing wrong with me, and I know exactly what they're going to do to me. I don't need you to tell me."
"I know, Jake. I know." And then, with the bravado and heedlessness of a child, he fell asleep. Chapter 18. The Murder Gene, Redux. One Tuesday morning near summer's end, Lori and I sat in Dr. Vogel's office for our weekly meeting under the eyes of those howling African masks. The session had not begun. We were still settling ourselves in our familiar chairs, making ritualistic comments about the warm weather outside, Lori shivering a little in the air conditioning, when the doctor announced,
"Andy, I have to tell you, I think this is going to be a difficult hour for you."
"Yeah, why is that?"
"We need to talk about some of the biological issues involved in this case, the genetics."
She hesitated. Dr. Vogel studiously maintained an impassive expression during our sessions, presumably to keep her own emotions from influencing ours. But this time her mouth and jaw clenched visibly.
"And I need to take a DNA sample from you. It's just a quick swab of your mouth, no needles, nothing intrusive. I just use a sterile Q-tip to wipe your gums and take a sample of your saliva."
"A DNA sample? You've got to be kidding me. I thought we were going to exclude all that."
"Andy, look, I'm a doctor, not a lawyer. I can't tell you what's going to be allowed into evidence or what will be excluded. That's between you and Jonathan. What I can tell you is that behavioral genetics, and by that I mean the science of how behavior is influenced by our genes, cuts two ways. The prosecution may want to introduce this sort of evidence to show that Jacob is violent by nature, a born killer, because obviously it makes it more likely that Jacob committed this murder. But we may want to introduce it too. If it gets to the point where the DA has likely proven Jacob actually killed this boy, I'm saying if, I'm not predicting, I'm not saying this is what I believe, just if, then we may want to bring in the genetic evidence as mitigation."
Lori said, "Mitigation?" I explained, "To reduce it from first-degree homicide to second, or manslaughter." Lori winced. The technical terms were discouraging, a reminder of how efficiently the system worked. A courthouse is a factory, sorting violence into a taxonomy of crimes, processing suspects into criminals. I was discouraged, too. The lawyer in me knew instantly the calculation Jonathan was making. Like a general preparing for battle, he was planning his fallback positions, a controlled tactical retreat. I told my son's mother in a gentle tone, "First degree is life without parole. It's a mandatory sentence. The judge has no discretion. With second degree, Jake would be parole eligible in 20 years. He'd only be 34. He'd still have a whole life ahead of him." Jonathan has asked me to research the issue, to prepare for it just in case. Laurie, I think the point, the easiest way to think of it is this. The law punishes intentional crimes. It presumes every act is intentional, a product of free will. If you did it, it is assumed you meant to do it. The law is very unforgiving of yes-but defenses. Yes, but I had a hard childhood. Yes, but I have a mental disease. Yes, but I was drunk. Yes, but I was carried away by anger. If you commit a crime, the law will say you are guilty despite these things, but it will take them into account when it comes to the precise definition of the crime and when it comes to the sentence. At that point, anything that affects your free will, including a genetic predisposition to violence or low impulse control, at least theoretically, can be taken into account. "It's ridiculous," I scoffed. "No jury would ever buy it. You're going to tell them I killed a 14-year-old boy but let me go anyway? Forget it, not going to happen." "We may not have a choice, Andy, if..." "This is bullshit," I told Dr. Vogel. "You going to take a sample of my DNA? I've never heard a fly." The doctor nodded. No reaction. A perfect shrink. She just sat there and let the words break over her like waves on a jetty, because that was the way to keep me talking. Somewhere she had learned that if an interviewer remains silent, the interviewee will rush to fill the silence. "I've never hurt anyone. I don't have a temper. That's just not me. I never even played football. My mother never let me. She knew I wouldn't like it. She knew. There was no violence in our house. When I was a kid, you know what I played? I played the clarinet. While all my friends were playing football, I played the clarinet." Laurie slid her hand over mine to smother my growing agitation. These sorts of gestures between us were becoming more rare, and I was moved by it. It calmed me. Dr. Vogel said, "Andy, I know you have a lot invested in this, in your identity, your reputation, the man you've become, the man you've made yourself. We've talked about that, and I understand perfectly. But that's exactly the point. We are not just a product of our genes. We are all a product of many, many things. Genes and environment, nature and nurture. The fact that you are who you are is the best example I know of the power of free will, of the individual. No matter what we find encoded in your genes, it will say nothing about who you are. Human behavior is much more complex than that. The same genetic sequence in one individual may produce a completely different result in different individuals and different environments. What we're talking about here is just a genetic predisposition. Predisposition is not predestination. We humans are much, much more than our DNA. The mistake people tend to make with a new science like this one is overdeterminism. We've discussed this before. We are not talking about the genes that code for blue eyes here. Human behavior has many, many more causes than simple physical traits." "That's a lovely speech, and yet you still want to stick a Q-tip in my mouth. What if I don't want to know what's in my DNA? What if I don't like what I'm programmed for?" "Andy, as hard as this is for you, it's not about you. It's about Jacob. The question is, how far will you go for Jacob? What will you do to protect your son?" "That's not fair." "It's the way it is. I didn't put you here." "No, Jonathan did. He's the one who should be telling me these things, not you." "Probably he doesn't want to fight with you about it. He doesn't even know if he'll use it at trial. It's just something he wants to keep in his pocket, just in case. Also, he might think you'd say no to him." "He's right. That's why he ought to be having this conversation himself." "He's just doing his job. You of all people should understand that." "His job is to do what his client wants." "His job is to win, Andy, not to spare anyone's feelings. Anyway, you're not the client. Jacob is. The only thing that matters here is Jacob. That's why we're all here, to help Jacob." "So Jonathan wants to argue in court that Jacob does have the murder gene."
If it comes down to it, if we get desperate, yes, we may have to argue that Jacob has certain specific gene variants that make him more likely to act in aggressive or antisocial ways. All those qualifications and nuances. To ordinary people, it's mumbo-jumbo. The newspapers will call it a murder gene. They'll say we're natural-born killers, our whole family. All we can do is tell them the truth. If they want to distort it, sensationalize it, what can we do? Okay, say I go for it. I let you take your DNA sample. Tell me exactly what it is you're looking for. Do you know anything about biology? Only what I got in high school. Were you any good in high school biology? I was better at clarinet. Okay, in a nutshell, bearing in mind that the causes of human behavior are infinitely complex and there is no simple genetic trigger for particular human behaviors, we are always talking about a gene-environment interaction. And anyway, criminal behavior is not a scientific term, it's a legal one, and certain behaviors that may be defined as criminal in one situation may not be criminal in another. Like war. Okay, I get it, it's complicated. Dumb it down for me. Just tell me. What are you looking for in my spit? She smiled, relenting. Okay. There are two specific gene variants that have been linked to male antisocial behavior, which might help account for multi-generational patterns of violence in families like yours. The first is an allele of a gene called MAOA. The MAOA gene is located on the X chromosome. It controls an enzyme that metabolizes certain neurotransmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. It's been called the warrior gene because of its association with aggressive behavior. The mutation is called MAOA knockout. It has been argued in court as a trigger for violence before, but the argument was too simplistic and it was rejected. Our understanding of the gene-environment interplay has improved since then. The science is getting better and very quickly, and we may have better testimony now. The second mutation is located in what's called the serotonin transporter gene. The official name for the gene is SLC6A4. It's located on chromosome 17. It encodes a protein that facilitates the activity of the serotonin transporter system, which is what enables the reuptake of serotonin from the synapse back into the neuron. I held up my hand. Enough. She said, "The point is, the science is good and it's getting better every day. Just imagine. Up till now, we've always asked, what causes human behavior? Is it nature or nurture? And we've been very good at studying the nurture side of the equation. There's lots and lots of good studies on how environment affects behavior. But now, for the first time in human history, we can look at the nature side. This is cutting-edge stuff. The structure of DNA was only discovered in 1953. We're just beginning to understand. We're just beginning to look at what we are, not as some abstraction like the soul or metaphor like the human heart, but the real mechanics of human beings, the nuts and bolts. This," she pinched the skin of her own arm and pulled up a sample of her own flesh, "the human body is a machine. It is a system, a very complex system, made of molecules and driven by chemical reactions and electrical impulses. Our minds are part of that system. People have no trouble accepting that nurture affects behavior. Why not nature? Doctor, will this keep my kid out of prison?" "It might. Then do it." "There's more. Why does this not surprise me?" "I need a swab from your father, too." "My father? You're joking. I haven't spoken to my father since I was 5 years old. I have no idea if he's even alive." "He is alive. He's in Northern Prison in Summers, Connecticut." "A beat. So go test him." "I tried. He won't see me." I blinked at her. I was wrong-footed both by the news that my father was alive and by the fact that she had already got a message from him. She had an advantage over me. Not only did she know my history, she did not consider it history at all. It was no burden to her. To Dr. Vogel, trying to contact Billy Barber was no harder than picking up the phone. "He says you have to ask." "Me? He wouldn't know me if I stood up in his soup." "Apparently he wants to change that."
"He does? Why?"
"A father gets old, he wants to know his son a little.
She shrugged. Who can understand the human heart?
So he knows about me?
Oh, he knows all about you.
I felt myself flush like a little kid with the thrill of it. A father. Then, just as quickly, my mood plummeted. The thought of bloody Billy Barber turned to acid.
Tell him to fuck off.
I can't tell him that. We need his help. We need a sample to argue that a genetic mutation is more than a one-off, but a family trait passed down from father to son to son.
We could get a court order, not without giving away to the DA what we're up to.
I shook my head.
Lori finally spoke.
Andy, you need to think about Jacob.
How far would you go for him?
I'd go to Helen back.
Okay, then. So you will.
Chapter 19. The Cutting Room. In the last week of August, that non-week, the week of Sundays when we all move a little slower and mourn the passing of summer and get ourselves ready for fall, the temperatures climbed and the air thickened until the heat was all anyone could talk about. When it would break, how high it would go, how unbearable the humidity was. It drove people indoors as if it was winter. The sidewalks and shops were oddly quiet. To me, the heat was not an affliction, it was merely a symptom, as a fever is a symptom of the flu. It was only the most obvious reason the world was fast becoming unbearable. We were all a little heat crazy by then, Lori and Jacob and I. Looking back on it, it is hard to believe how self-absorbed I had become, how this whole story seemed to be about me, not Jacob, not our entire family. Jacob's guilt and mine were entangled in my mind, though no one had ever accused me of anything explicitly. I was coming apart, of course. I knew this. I distinctly remember exhorting myself to hold it together, to keep up appearances, not to crack. But I did not share my feelings with Lori, and I did not try to draw out hers either, because we were all coming apart. I discouraged any sort of frank emotional talk, and soon enough I stopped noticing my wife altogether. I never asked, never even asked, what the experience was like for the mother of Jacob the murderer. I thought it was more important to be, at least to seem, a tower of strength, and to encourage her to be strong as well. It was the only sensible approach. Tough it out, get through the trial, do whatever it takes to keep Jacob safe, then repair the emotional damage later. After. It was as if there was a place called After, and if I could just push my family across to that shore, then everything would be all right. There would be time for all these soft problems in the land of After. I was wrong. I think about that now. How I should have seen Lori then, should have paid more attention. She had saved my life once. I came to her damaged, and she had loved me anyway. And when she was damaged, I did not lift a finger to help her. I only noticed that her hair was getting grayer and sloppier, and her face was becoming crazed with lines like an old ceramic vase. She had lost so much weight that her hip bones protruded, and when we were together she spoke less and less. In spite of it all, I never softened in my determination to save Jacob first and heal Lori later. I try to rationalize that merciless intransigence now. I was by then a master of internalizing dangerous emotions. My mind was overheated with the stress of that endless summer. It was all true, and it is all bullshit, too. The truth is, I was a fool. Lori, I was a fool. I know that now. I went to the Hughes home around 10 o'clock one morning. Derek's parents both worked, even during this pseudo-vacation week. I knew Derek would be home alone. He and Jacob were still texting regularly. They even spoke on the phone, though only during the day when Derek's parents were not around to hear. I was convinced Derek would want to help his friend. He would want to talk to me, tell me the truth. But I was afraid he would not let me in anyway. He was a good kid. He would do as he had been told, as he always did, always had done. So I was prepared to talk my way into the house, even to force my way in to get to him. I remember feeling quite capable of that. I came to the house wearing baggy cargo shorts and a t-shirt that stuck to my sweaty back. I had gained some weight since all this began,
and I recall that the shorts shimmied down my hips over and over, weighted down by my gut. I had to hike them up constantly. I had always been fit and trim. My sloppy new body made me ashamed, but I felt no inclination to fix it. Again, there would be time after. Arriving at the Hughes home, I did not knock. I did not want to give the kid a chance to hide from me, to see me and refuse to answer the door, pretend he was not there. Instead, I went around to the back, past the little flower garden, past a hydrangea shooting white conical bunches of flowers in every direction like fireworks. A blossoming that David Yu waited all year for, I remembered. The Yus had built an extension off the back of their house. It contained a mudroom and a breakfast room. The walls were windowed all around. From the back deck, I could see in through the kitchen to the little sitting area where Derek sprawled on a couch in front of the TV. There was patio furniture on this deck, an umbrellaed table and six chairs. If Derek had refused to let me in, I might have thrown one of those heavy patio chairs through the French door, like William Hurt in Body Heat. But the door was unlocked. I walked right into the house as if I owned it, as if I had just run out to the garage to take out the trash. Inside, the house was cool, air-conditioned. Derek scrambled to his feet, but he did not come toward me. He stood with his skinny calves against the couch, in gym shorts and a black T-shirt with the Zildjian logo across the chest. His bare feet were long and bony, his toes pressed down into the carpet, arching like little caterpillars. Nerves. When I first met Derek, he was 5 years old and still pudgy. Now he was another scrawny, gangly, slightly spaced-out teenage kid like my own. He was just like Jacob in every way but one. There was no cloud on Derek's future, nothing to obstruct him. He would move through adolescence with the same zonked-out expression as Jacob, same crap clothes, same shambling, no-eye-contact manner, and he would pass right on into adulthood. He was the blameless kid Jacob might have been, and I thought briefly how nice it would be to have such an uncomplicated kid. I envied David Yu even as I considered him, at the moment, an asshole without peer. "Hello, Derek."
"Hi."
"What's wrong, Derek?"
"You're not supposed to be here."
"I've been here 100 times.
"Yeah, but you're not supposed to be here now."
"I just want to talk. About Jacob."
"I'm not supposed to."
"Derek, what's wrong with you? You're all flustered."
"No."
"Are you afraid of me?"
"No."
"Then why are you acting like this?"
"Like what? I'm not doing anything."
"You look like you just shit a brick."
"No, it's just you're not supposed to be here."
"Relax, Derek. Sit down. I just want to know the truth, that's all. What on earth is going on here? What's really going on? I just wish someone would tell me." I moved through the kitchen into the TV room cautiously, as if I were approaching a skittish animal. "I don't care what your parents said, Derek. Your parents are wrong. Jacob deserves your help. He's your friend. Your friend.
I am too.
I'm your friend, and this is what friends do, Derek. They help each other. That's all I want, is for you to be Jacob's friend right now. He needs you." I sat down. "What did you tell LaJudas? What could you possibly have told him that would make him believe my son is a murderer?"
"I didn't say Jake is a murderer."
"What did you tell him then?"
"Why don't you ask LaJudas? I thought he had to tell you."
"He's supposed to, Derek, but he's playing games. He's not a good guy, Derek. I know it might be hard for you to understand that. He didn't put you in front of the grand jury because then he would have to provide me with a transcript. He probably did not have you talk to a detective either, because then the cop would have written a report. So I need you to tell me, Derek. I need you to do the right thing. Tell me what you said to LaJudas that made him so sure Jacob is guilty."
"I told him the truth."
"Oh, I know, Derek. Everyone tells the truth. It's so tiresome. Because it's never the same truth. So I need to know exactly what you said."
"I'm not supposed—"
"Damn it, Derek, what did you say?" He recoiled, then plunked down on the couch as if the shout had blasted him backward. I calmed myself. I said in a soft voice, just short of despair, "Please, Derek. Please tell me."
"I just told him, you know, some things that have been going on in school."
"Like what?"
"Like Jake was getting picked on. Ben Rifkin was like the leader of this group of kids. like slacker kids. They were kind of giving Jake a hard time.
About what?
Like saying he was gay. That was the main thing. Just like rumors. Ben just made stuff up. And you know, I don't even care if Jake is gay. I really don't. I wish he'd just say it if he was.
Do you think he's gay?
I don't know, maybe. But it doesn't matter because he didn't do any of the things Ben said he did. Ben just made it up. He just liked tooling on Jake for some reason, like it was a game for him or something. He was kind of a bully.
What did Ben say?
I don't know, just like starting rumors. Like, he said Jake offered to blow a kid at this party, which he didn't. Or that he got a boner in the shower after track one day. Or that one of the teachers went back into school during recess one day and caught Jake jerking off in one of the classrooms. It was all totally not true.
Why did he say it then?
Because Ben was a dick. There was just something about Jake that Ben didn't like, and that kind of got him excited, you know? It was like he couldn't help himself. If he saw Jake, he gave him a rash of shit. Every time. I guess he figured he could get away with it, too. He was just a dick. To be honest, nobody likes to say it because he got killed and everything, but Ben was a mean kid. Whoever did this, well, I don't know, I don't want to say, whatever. Ben was just a mean kid.
But why was he mean to Jacob? I don't get that.
He just didn't like him. Jake is like, I mean, I know Jake, okay? And I like him, but come on, I mean, you have to know Jake isn't like a normal kid.
Why not? Because kids thought he was gay?
No.
Then what does normal mean? He gave me a searching look.
Jake has a mean streak of his own.
Derek held his eyes on me. I tried not to betray any emotion. I tried to stop my Adam's apple from bobbing up and down. Derek said,
I think maybe Ben didn't know that. Ben kind of picked the wrong little freak to pick on. He had no clue.
So that's why you went on Facebook and told everyone about the knife?
No, it was more than that. I mean, it was like the whole reason he got the knife was he was afraid of Ben. He thought Ben was going to go after him someday and try to mess him up, and then Jake was going to have to defend himself.
You never knew about any of this?
No.
Jacob never told you about any of this?
No.
Well, I told because I knew Jake got the knife, and I knew it was because he was afraid Ben was going to try something. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything. I don't know. I don't know why I told.
You told because it was the truth. Because you wanted to tell the truth.
I guess. But that knife wasn't the murder weapon. The knife you saw that Jacob had. It's not the one that killed Ben. They found another knife in Cold Spring Park. You know that, right?
Yeah, but who knows? They found a knife.
Shrug.
Anyway, it was like at the time everybody was still talking about where's the knife? And Jake always used to say, like, my dad's a DA and I know about the law, like he knew what he could get away with. Like if anyone ever accused him, you know.
Did he ever say that?
No, not exactly.
So, is that what you told LaJudas?
No, course not. 'Cause, like, this isn't stuff I really know, you know, this is just, like, what I think.
So what exactly did you tell LaJudas?
Just that Jacob had a knife.
The wrong knife.
Well, if that's what you want to say, whatever. I just told LaJudas about the knife and that Ben was kind of bullying him. And that the morning it happened, Jake came into school with blood on him.
Which Jacob admits. He found Ben. He tried to help him. That's how he got the blood on him.
I know, Aunt... Mr. Barber. I'm not saying anything about Jake. I'm just telling you what I told the DA. Jake came into school and I saw blood on him and he told me he had to clean it up because people wouldn't understand. And he was right, they didn't.
Derek, can I ask you something? Do you really think it's possible? I mean, is there anything else you're not telling me? Because what I'm hearing, it still doesn't make sense that Jacob did this. It just doesn't add up.
Derek squirmed, his body corkscrewed away from me.
You think he did it, don't you, Derek?
No. I mean, there's like a 1% chance, you know? Just like a little bit of...
He held up his fingers a millimeter apart.
I don't know.
Doubt.
Yeah.
Why?
Why would you have even a little bit of doubt? You've known Jacob most of your life. You've been best friends.
Because Jake, he's just kind of a different kid.
You know, I'm not saying anything, all right? But he's just kind of... I said he had, like, a mean streak, but that isn't really it. I don't know how to say it. It's not like he has a temper or he gets mad or anything. He doesn't get mad, you know? He just... he's kind of mean. Not to me, because I'm his friend, but to other kids, sometimes. He just says weird things. Like racist stuff, just jokes. Or he calls fat girls fat, or he says inappropriate stuff about them, like about their bodies. And he reads these stories on the net, kind of porn, but about torture. He calls it cutter, like cutter porn. He'll say, like, dude, I was up so late reading cutter on the net last night. He showed me some of the stories, like on his iPod, and I'm like, dude, this is sick. You know, it's like stories about, you know, cutting people, like tying women up and cutting them and killing them and stuff? And tying up men and cutting stuff off and... he grimaced. You know, castrating them? It's totally sick. He still does it. What do you mean he still does it? He reads it. That's not true. I've been checking the computer. I put a program on it that tells me what Jacob does and where he goes on the internet. He uses his iPod. That iPod Touch? For a moment, I was the stupid, out-of-touch parent. Derek said helpfully, he finds them on these forums on the net, this site called The Cutting Room. People trade stories, I guess. They write them and post them for other people to read. Derek, kids look at porn, I know that. You're sure that's not just what we're talking about? I'm totally, totally sure this is not porn. Anyway, it's not even just that. I mean, he can read whatever he wants, it's none of my business. But he just has this thing where he kind of doesn't care. Doesn't care about what? About people, about animals, about anything. He shook his head. I sat silent, waiting. One time we were out, a group of us, and we were just kind of sitting on this wall, like hanging out. It was the middle of the afternoon. And this guy goes by on the sidewalk, and he has these kind of like crutches. Like, you know, those kind that go up over your arm and there's like a ring that goes over your arm. And he couldn't really control his legs. He just sort of dragged them like he was paralyzed or he had some disease or something. And this guy goes by and Jake just starts laughing. I mean, not like quiet laughing, but really loud, like crazy laughing, like, ha 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 ha. He wouldn't stop. The guy must have heard him. He went right past us, right in front of us. And we're all just kind of looking at Jacob like, dude, what's wrong with you? And he's like, are you guys all blind? Didn't you even see that guy? He's a total freak show. It was just mean. I mean, I know you're Jacob's dad and all, and I don't like to say this, but Jake can be just mean. I don't like being around him when he's like that. I get a little scared of him, to tell you the truth. Derek made a sad little grimace, as if he was making a difficult admission to himself for the first time. His friend Jake had let him down. He went on in a less disgusted, more mournful tone. Once, this was like last fall, I guess, Jake found this dog. Just like a little mutt. He was lost, I guess, but he wasn't a stray because he had a collar on. Jake had him on like a string, you know, instead of a leash. Jacob never had a dog, I said. Derek nodded at me with that same sad expression, as if it was his duty to explain this to Jacob's poor, clueless father. He seemed to know, finally, how oblivious parents can be, and it disappointed him. I saw him later, and I asked him about the dog, and Jake was like, I had to bury it. So I was like, you mean it died? And he wouldn't really answer. He was just like, dude, I had to bury it. I didn't see Jake for a while after that, because I sort of knew, you know? Like, I knew it was bad. And there were these posters, like the family that owned the dog, they put up these posters all over the place, like stapled on phone poles and trees, you know, like with pictures of this dog. And I never said anything about it, and finally the family stopped putting up the posters, and I just kind of tried to forget about it. A moment passed in silence. When I was sure he had nothing more to add, I said, Derek, if you knew all this, how could you and Jacob still be friends? We're not friends like we used to be, like when we were kids. We're just kind of old friends, you know? It's different. Old friends, but still friends? I don't know. Sometimes I think it's like he was never my real friend, you know? He was just kind of this kid I knew from school. I don't think he ever, like, cared about me. Not that he didn't like me or anything. He just didn't care either way most of the time.
And the rest of the time?
Derek shrugged.
His answer was a bit of a non sequitur, but I'll put it down here just as he said it.
I always figured he'd get into trouble someday. I just figured it would be when we were grown up.
We sat there a while, Derek and I, not saying anything. We both understood, I think, that there was no going back, no unsaying the things he had just said. I drove home slowly through the town center, savoring the ride. Maybe it is only an error of hindsight, but it seems to me now that I knew what was coming. I knew this was the end of something, and it was a tiny pleasure to prolong the car ride, to be normal a while longer. At home, I continued to move in that deliberate way, up the stairs to my son's room. His iPod Touch was on the bureau, a sleek, glassy little slab that came alive in my hand. The iPod was password-protected, but Jacob had surrendered the password to us as a condition of keeping the iPod. I entered the 4-digit password and opened the web browser. Jacob kept only a handful of obvious sites bookmarked: Facebook, Gmail, a few blogs he liked about technology and video games and music. There was no trace of a site called The Cutting Room. I had to do a Google search to find it. The Cutting Room was a message board, a place where visitors could post plain text messages for others to read. The site was filled with stories that were essentially what Derek had described. Extended sexual fantasies involving bondage and sadism, even mutilation, rape, murder. Some, a tiny fraction, seemed to have no sexual element. They described torture for its own sake, rather like the ultra-gory spatter horror movies that fill the theaters now. The site had no images or video, only text, and even that was unformatted. From the stripped-down browser on the iPod, it was impossible to tell which of these stories Jacob had read or how long he had spent on the site. But the page did show that Jacob was a member of this message board. His screen name, Job, was displayed at the top of the page. I presume Job was a play on his first name or his initials, though Jacob's middle initial was not O, or maybe it was a sly reference to the trials he was enduring. I clicked on the username Job, and a link took me to a page where Job's favorite stories on the site were saved. A dozen stories were listed. At the top of the list was a story called A Walk in the Woods. It was dated April 19th, over 3 months earlier. The fields for the author and uploader both were blank. It began, "Jason Fears took a knife into the woods that morning because he figured he might need it. He kept the knife in his sweatshirt pocket, and as he walked, he curled his fingers around the grip, and the knife in his fist sent a surge up his arm and through his shoulder and into his brain and lit up his solar plexus like a firework going off in the sky." The story went on in long, unfurling purple sentences like that one. It was a lurid, barely fictionalized account of the murder of Ben Rifkin in Cold Spring Park. In the story, the park was renamed Rock River Park. Newton was called Brooktown. Ben Rifkin became a shifty, villainous bully called Brent Malice. I assumed Jacob wrote it, but there was no way to be certain. There was nothing in the story that gave away the writer's identity. The voice did sound like an adolescent, and Jacob was a bookish boy who had been lurking in the cutting room long enough to learn the genre. The author had at least a passing knowledge of Cold Spring Park, which was described pretty accurately. Still, the most I could say with certainty was that Jacob had read the story, which proved nothing, really. So I got on with the business of lawyering away at the evidence, minimizing it, defending Jacob. The story was no confession. There was nothing in it that I recognized as non-public information. The whole thing might have been pieced together out of newspaper clippings and a vivid imagination. Even the most chilling detail, when Ben, or Brent Malice, cried, "Stop, you're hurting me," had been widely reported in the newspapers. As for the non-public information, how accurate was any of it? Even the investigators had no way of knowing whether Ben Rifkin really said, "Hey, faggot," when he saw his killer in the woods that morning, as Brent Malice said to Jason Fears, or whether, when the killer stabbed Ben in the chest, the knife slipped in with no resistance, no bump of bone,
no sticking on skin or rubbery organs, like he was stabbing into the air. These things were unwitnessed, unconfirmable. Anyway, Jacob would have realized it was idiotic to write this trash, whether or not he was actually guilty. Yes, he had posted the psycho photo on Facebook, but surely he would not go this far. Even if he had written it or just read it, what did it prove? It would be stupid, yes, but kids do stupid things. The interior of a teenager's mind is an endless war between stupid and clever. This was just a case of stupid winning a battle. Considering the pressure Jake was under and the fact he'd been practically locked up in the house for months, and now the growing clamor as the trial approached, it was understandable. Could you really hold the kid responsible for every tasteless, tactless, brainless thing he said? What kid would not begin to act a little crazy in Jacob's situation? Anyway, who among us would be judged by the dumbest things we did as teenagers? I told myself these things. I marshaled my arguments, as I'd been trained to do, but I could not get that boy's cry out of my head. Stop, you're hurting me. And something in me tore open. I don't know how else to put it. I still would not admit doubt into my thinking. I still believed in Jacob, and God knows I still loved him, and there was no evidence, no real proof of anything. The lawyer in me understood all this, but the part of me that was Jacob's father felt cut, wounded. An emotion is a thought, yes, an idea, but it is also a sensation, an ache in your body. Desire, love, hate, fear, repulsion. You feel these things in your muscle and bones, not just in your mind. That is how this little heartbreak felt, like a physical injury deep inside my body, an internal bleeding, a nick that would continue to seep. I read the story again, then I cleared it from the browser's memory. I put the iPod back on Jacob's bureau, and I would have left it there and never said anything to him about it. Certainly never would have said anything to Lori either. But I worried there might be danger in the iPod. I was familiar enough with the internet and with police work to know that digital footprints are not easily erased. Every click on the web creates a record, on servers out in the ether, and also on the hard drives of individual computers. And these records persist no matter how you try to delete them. What if the DA somehow found Jacob's iPod and scoured it for evidence? The iPod was dangerous in another way, too, as a portal to the web for Jacob that I could not police as easily as the family computers. The iPod was small and phone-like, and Jacob used it with the same expectation of privacy that he would if it were a phone. He was careless with it, and maybe sneaky, too. The iPod was a leak. It was a danger. I brought it down to the basement and laid it on my little work table, glass side up, and I got a hammer and smashed it. Chapter 20. One son was here, the other was gone. The market closest to our house was a Whole Foods, and we loathed it. The wastefulness of all those pyramids of immaculate fruit and vegetables which, we knew, could only be created by throwing away enormous amounts of cosmetically imperfect food. The bogus earthiness, an elaborate pretense that Whole Foods was something other than a luxury store. And, of course, the prices. We had always avoided shopping there because of the high prices. Now, with Jacob's case threatening to bankrupt us, the thought of it seemed particularly ludicrous. We had no business shopping there. We were already ruined financially. We were not rich people to begin with. We had been able to live in this town only because we had bought in when prices were low and because we were leveraged up to our eyeballs. Now Jonathan's fee was already into six figures. We had spent all of Jacob's college money on it and begun dipping into retirement savings. Before the case was over, I was sure we would be wiped out, borrowing against the house to pay the bills. I knew also that my career as a prosecutor was over. Even if the verdict was not guilty, I would never be able to walk into a courtroom without trailing the stink of the accusation. Maybe after the case was ended, Lynn Canavan would do the right thing and offer to keep me on the payroll. But I could not stay there, not as a charity case. Lori might be able to go back to teaching, but we would not be able to pay the bills on her income alone. This is an aspect of crime stories I never fully appreciated until I became one.
It is so ruinously expensive to mount a defense that, innocent or guilty, the accusation is itself a devastating punishment. Every defendant pays a price. There was another reason for us to avoid Whole Foods as well. I was determined not to be seen around town, certainly not to do anything that might suggest we were taking the case lightly. It was a question of image. I wanted people to see our family as shattered because we were shattered. When the jury pool filed into the courtroom, I did not want any of them to harbor some vague memory of the barbers luxuriating in pricey shops while the Rifkin boy lay buried in the ground. An unflattering mention in the newspaper, a fanciful rumor, a baseless impression, these things could easily tip the jury against us. But we went to Whole Foods one evening, all three of us, when time was short and we were sick of all the wariness and waiting and we were hungry. It was just before Labor Day. The town had emptied out for the holiday. And what a relief it was to be there. We were lulled by the wonderful narcotic ordinariness of shopping at the market. We were so like our old selves, Lori the competent shopper and meal planner, me the bumbling husband grabbing the odd item here or there on a whim, Jacob the kid whimpering for something to eat right away before we reached the register, that we forgot ourselves. We strolled up and down the aisles. We enjoyed the packages banked up around us, made little jokes about the organic foods on the shelves. At the cheese section, Jacob made a joke about the smell of a potent Gruyere that they were offering customers to taste and the possible gastric consequences of eating too much of it. And we all laughed, all three of us, not because the joke was especially funny, though I am not above a good fart joke, but because Jacob had made a joke at all. Over the summer he had become so silent, such an enigma to us, that we celebrated just to see our little boy peeking out at us again. He smiled, and it was impossible to believe he was the monster everyone seemed to think he was. We were still smiling when we came out of this last aisle into the cash register area at the front of the store. All the aisles drained here, and the shoppers eddied around, sorting themselves into checkout lines. We took our place at the end of a short line with just a couple of people in front of us. Lori stood with her hand on the push bar of the cart. I stood beside her. Jacob was behind us. Dan Rifkin guided his cart into the checkout line beside ours. He was 5 feet away, if that. For a moment, he did not see us. His sunglasses rested on the top of his head, pillowed in his hair. He wore neatly pressed khaki shorts and a tucked-in polo shirt. His belt was canvas with a blue band on which was embroidered a pattern of little ship's anchors. He wore thin-soled loafers without socks. It was the sort of country club casual style that I have always thought looks ridiculous on a grown man. A naturally formal person often looks odd when he tries to dress down, just as a natural slob looks out of place in a suit. Dan Rifkin was not the sort of guy who looked at home in short pants. I turned my back to him and whispered to Lori that he was beside us. Her hand went over her mouth. Where? Right behind me. Don't look. She looked. I turned back to find Rifkin's wife, Joan, had appeared beside him. She had some of her husband's miniature doll-like quality. She was small and slim and had a lovely face. Her frosted blonde hair was cut in a pixie. She must have been very beautiful once. She still had the vivacious actressy manner of a woman who knows how to use her looks. But she was fading now. Her face was gaunt and her eyes bugged slightly, with years, with stress, with grief. I had met her several times over the years before all this happened. She never remembered who I was. Now the two of them stared at us. Dan hardly moved. His keys dangled from his hooked index finger without jangling. His consternation, or surprise, or whatever he was feeling, barely registered on his face. Joan's face was more animated. She glared, offended by our presence here. No one had to say anything. It was a matter of numbers. We were three, they were two. One son was here, the other gone. The simple fact of Jacob's continued existence must have seemed profane to them. It was also painfully obvious and awkward that the five of us stood there dumbstruck for a moment, gaping at each other while the commotion of the market went on around us. I told Jacob, "Why don't you go wait in the car?" "Okay." He began to move off. The Rifkins still stared. I had decided immediately not to say anything unless they initiated the conversation. It was impossible to imagine what I could say that would not be painful or tactless or provocative. But Lori wanted to speak. Her desire to walk over to them was palpable. With great effort, she was restraining herself. I find it touching and almost naive how complete is my wife's faith in communication and connection. To her, there is virtually no problem that does not benefit from a little talk, talk, talk. What is more, she genuinely believed that the case was somehow a shared misfortune, that our family was suffering also, that it was no easy thing to see your son wrongly accused of murder, to see his life ruined for no good reason. The tragedy of Ben Rifkin's murder did not lessen the tragedy of Jake's own victimization. I don't think Lori meant to say any of this. She is much too empathetic. I think she just wanted to communicate her sympathy somehow, to connect with the usual banality of, "I'm so sorry for your loss," or some such. Lori said, Lori, I cut her off, "go wait in the car with Jacob. I'll pay for the stuff." It did not cross my mind simply to leave. We had a right to be there. We had a right to eat, surely. Lori moved past me toward Joan Rifkin. I made a half-hearted effort to stop her, but there was never any way to talk my wife out of something once she decided to do it. She was a mule, a sweet, empathetic, brilliant, sensitive, lovely woman, but a mule just the same. She walked right up to them and made a gesture with her hands, extending them palms up as if she wanted to take Joan's hands in hers, or maybe just signaling that she did not know exactly what to say, or that she carried no weapons. Joan met this gesture by crossing her arms. Dan raised his own arm slightly. He looked like he was getting ready to hold Lori off if for some reason she attacked. Lori said, "Joan." Joan spat in her face. She did it very suddenly, without bothering to work up the saliva in her mouth, and not much came out. It was more of a gesture, perhaps the gesture she thought was appropriate in the circumstances. But then, who could ever be prepared for circumstances like these? Lori covered her face with both hands, wiped the spit with her fingers. "Murderers," Joan said. I went to Lori and put my hand on her shoulder. She was as still as stone. Joan glowered up at me. If she were a man or if she was less genteel, maybe she would have gone after me. She quivered with hatred like a tuning fork. I could not hate her back. I could not be angry with her, could not find much feeling at all for her except sadness. Sadness for all of us. I said to Dan, "Sorry," as if there was no point in talking to Joan and it was up to us men to handle the emotions that our wives could not. I took Lori's hand and led her out of the store with elaborate politeness, saying softly over and over, "Excuse us, sorry, excuse us," as we squeezed past the other shoppers and their carts and out into the parking lot where no one recognized us, and we were returned to the semi-anonymity that we still enjoyed in those last few weeks before the trial, before the deluge. "We didn't get our things," Lori said. "It's okay. We don't need them." Chapter 21. Beware the fury of a patient man. It is the happy lot of defense lawyers to see the good in people. No matter how wicked or incomprehensible the crime, no matter how overwhelming the evidence of guilt, the defense lawyer never forgets his client is a human being like the rest of us. That, of course, is what makes every defendant worth defending. I cannot tell you how many times a lawyer has suggested to me that his baby shaker or wife beater really isn't a bad guy. Even the swaggering mercenaries with their gold Rolexes and alligator briefcases harbor this tiny redeeming fleck of humanism. Every criminal is still a man, a complex of good and bad, fully deserving of our empathy and mercy. To cops and prosecutors, things are not so sunny. We have the opposite impulse. We are quick to see the stain, the worm, the latent criminality in even the best people. Experience tells us the nice man next door is capable of anything. The priest may be a pedophile, the cop a crook. The loving husband and father may harbor a filthy secret. Of course, we believe these things for the same reason the defender believes as he does.
people are only human. The more I watched Leonard Patz, the more I became convinced he was Ben Rifkin's killer. I followed him on his morning rounds, to Dunkin' Donuts, then to work at Staples, and I was there when he came out of work, too. His Staples uniform made him look ridiculous. The red polo shirt hugged his flabby torso too tightly. Khaki pants accentuated the sort of bulging pelvis that Jacob and his pals call a front butt. I did not dare go into the store to see what they had Patz selling. Electronics, probably. Computers. Cell phones. He looked like the type. Of course, it is the prosecutor's privilege to choose his defendant, but I simply could not understand why LeJudas preferred Jacob to this man. Maybe it is a parent's wishful thinking or a prosecutor's cynicism, but I still do not understand it, even now. By August, I had been following Patz around for weeks, in the mornings and evenings, before and after his workday. Matt McGrath's information was proof positive as far as I was concerned, but it would not fly in court. No jury would ever accept his word. I needed harder evidence, something that did not rely on that shifty kid. I do not know what exactly I was hoping to see by trailing Patz around like this. A stumble, a return to the scene, a late-night drive to dispose of evidence, anything. In the event, Patz did nothing especially suspicious. For that matter, he did not do very much at all. In his off hours, he seemed content to loaf in shops or hang out in his apartment near Cold Spring Park. He liked to eat at the McDonald's on Soldiers Field Road in Brighton, where he would order at the drive-thru and eat in his plum-colored car while listening to the radio. Once, he went to the movies by himself. None of it was remotely significant. But nothing he did ever shook my certainty that Patz was the one. The outrageous possibility that my son would be sacrificed to save this man became an obsession. I grew more and more addled the longer I followed him, stared at him, the longer I dwelt on this idea. The dullness of his life, far from dispelling my suspicion, only infuriated me all the more. He was hiding, laying low, waiting for LeJudas to do his work for him. On a sultry Wednesday evening in August, I followed directly behind Patz's car as he made his way home through Newton Center, a shopping area and village green where several busy roads intersect. It was around 5 o'clock and still sunny. Traffic was lighter than usual. This is the sort of town that empties out in August. But still bumper to bumper. Most drivers had their car windows rolled up tight against the humid heat. A few, including Patz and me, kept our windows open and hung our left elbows out for a little relief. Even the ice cream eaters on the sidewalk outside J.P. Licks had a limp, defeated look. At a red light, I nuzzled in behind Patz's car. I clenched the steering wheel tight. Patz's brake lights flickered and his car lurched slightly. I lifted my foot off the brake. I don't know why. I was not sure how far I intended to take it. But I was happy, for the first time in a long time, as my car rolled forward and bumped his with a satisfying chunk. He looked at me in his rearview mirror and raised his hands. What was that? I shrugged, backed the car up a few feet, then knocked his bumper again, a little harder this time. Chunk. Through his rear window, I saw his shadowy shape put up its hands again in exasperation. I watched him shift the car into park, open the door, and hoist his bulk up out of the car. And I became a different person. A different person, yet I moved and acted with a naturalness and fluency that was wild and unfamiliar, and thrilling. I was out of the car and moving toward him before I was quite aware of my own motion, without ever actually deciding to confront him. He raised his hands in front of his chest, palms forward, and his face registered surprise. I gathered his shirt up in my hands and thrust him against the car, bending him backward. I buried my snout in his face and growled, "I know what you did." He did not respond. "I know what you did." "What are you talking about? Who are you?" "I know about the boy in Cold Spring Park."
"Oh my God, you're crazy."
"You have no idea."
"I don't know what you're talking about, honest. You've got the wrong guy."
"Yeah? Do you remember going to meet Ben Rifkin in the park? Do you remember telling Matt McGrath you were going to do that?"
"Matt McGrath?
How long were you watching Ben Rifkin? How long were you stalking him? Did you ever talk to him? Did you bring your knife that day? What happened? Did you offer him the same deal you had with Matt? $100 for a feel?
Did he turn you down? Did he make fun of you, call you names? Did he try to beat you up, push you around, scare you? What set you off, Leonard? What made you do it?
You're the father, aren't you?
No, I'm not Ben's father.
No, the one that got charged. You're the father. They told me about you. The DA said you'd try to talk to me.
What DA?
LeJudas.
What did he say?
He said you had this idea in your head and you might try to talk to me someday and I shouldn't talk to you. He said you were...
What?
He said you were crazy. He said you might be violent.
I let go of Pat's and stepped back.
I was surprised to find I had lifted him off the ground. He slid down the side of his car, landing on his heels. His red Staples uniform shirt was pulled up out of his Dockers khakis, bearing an expansive round belly, but he did not dare straighten himself up yet. He eyed me cautiously.
I know what you did, I assured him, coming back into myself. No way my kid is going away because of you.
But I didn't do anything.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Matt told me all about it.
Please just leave me alone. I didn't do anything. I'm just doing what the DA told me to do.
I nodded, feeling exposed and out of control, embarrassed. I know what you did, I said again, low and certain, as much to myself this time as to Pat's. The phrase comforted me, like a little prayer.
Mr. LeJudas, and did you continue following Leonard Pat's after that day?
Witness, yes.
Mr. LeJudas, why, what on earth did you hope to accomplish?
Witness,
I was trying to solve the case to prove Pat's was the murderer.
Mr. LeJudas, you really believed that?
Witness, yes, you made the wrong call, Neil. The evidence pointed at Pat's, not Jacob.
That was your best case. You were supposed to follow the evidence wherever it led. That was your job.
Mr. LeJudas, boy, you don't give up, do you?
Witness, you don't have kids, do you, Neil?
Mr. LeJudas,
no.
Witness, no, I didn't think so. If you did, you'd understand. Did you tell Pat's not to talk to me?
Mr. LeJudas,
yes.
Witness, because you knew if the jury heard the evidence against Pat's, they never would have believed Jacob did it. You were loading the dice, isn't that right?
Mr. LeJudas, I was prosecuting my case. I was prosecuting the suspect I believed did it. That's my job.
Witness,
then why are you so afraid to let the jury hear about Pat's?
Mr. LeJudas,
because he didn't do it. I was doing what I thought was right, based on the evidence I had at the time. Andy, look, you're not the one asking questions here. That's not your job anymore. It's mine.
Witness,
it's just strange, isn't it, telling a guy like that not to talk to the defense? It's burying exculpatory evidence, isn't it? But you had your reasons, didn't you, Neil?
Mr. LeJudas,
would you at least, please, call me Mr. LeJudas. I've earned that at least.
Witness, tell them, Neil.
Go on, tell them how you knew Leonard Pat's.
Tell them what the jury never heard.
Mr. LeJudas, let's move on.
Chapter 22. A Heart Two Sizes Too Small. Mr. LeJudas,
directing your attention to a document that's been marked Exhibit 22, do you recognize this document?
Witness, yes, it's a letter from Dr. Vogel to Jonathan Klein, our defense lawyer.
Mr. LeJudas,
and the date?
Witness, it's dated October 2nd.
Mr. LeJudas,
2 weeks before the trial.
Witness, yes, give or take.
Mr. LeJudas,
the bottom of the letter says, CC, Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Barber. Were you shown this letter at the time?
Witness, yes, I was.
Mr. LeJudas,
but your attorney never turned over this document in discovery, is that correct?
Witness, not as far as I know.
Mr. LeJudas,
not as far as anyone knows.
Witness, don't testify, Neil. Come on, ask a question.
Mr. LeJudas,
all right.
Why was this document never turned over to the prosecution?
Witness,
because it's privileged. It's a doctor-patient communication and its work product, which means it was created by the defense team as part of its trial preparation. That makes it confidential. It's exempt from discovery.
Mr. LeJudas,
but you've produced it now, and in response to an ordinary boilerplate discovery order. Why? Are you waiving the privilege?
Witness. The privilege isn't mine to waive, but it doesn't matter now, does it? The only thing that matters now is the truth.
Mr. LeJudas. Here we go. This is the part where you tell us how you believe in the system and all that.
Witness. The system is as good as the people running it, Neil.
Mr. LeJudas. Did you believe in Dr. Vogel?
Witness. Yes, completely.
Mr. LeJudas.
And you have confidence in her now? Nothing has happened to shake your faith in the doctor's observations?
Witness. I trust her. She's a good doctor.
Mr. LeJudas. So you don't dispute anything in this letter?
Witness.
No.
Mr. LeJudas.
And what was the purpose of this letter?
Witness. It was an opinion letter. It was meant to summarize the doctor's findings about Jacob so that Jonathan could make a decision about whether to call Dr. Vogel as a witness and whether he wanted to get into this whole subject at all, the subject of Jacob's mental health.
Mr. LeJudas. Would you read the second paragraph to the grand jury, please?
Witness.
The client presents as an articulate, intelligent, polite 14-year-old boy. His manner is shy, and he is somewhat reticent in conversation, but nothing in his conduct suggests a compromised ability to perceive, recall, or relate the incidents involved in this case, or to assist trial counsel in making informed, intelligent, well-reasoned decisions pertaining to his own legal defense.
Mr. LeJudas.
What the doctor is saying there is that, in her professional opinion, Jacob was competent to stand trial, isn't that right?
Witness. That's a legal opinion, not a clinical one, but yes, obviously, the doctor is aware of the standard.
Mr. LeJudas.
And what about criminal responsibility? The doctor addresses that question in her letter as well, doesn't she? Look at paragraph 3.
Witness.
Yes.
Mr. LeJudas. Read it, please.
Witness.
Quote, there is insufficient evidence as yet to conclude definitively whether Jacob adequately perceives the distinction between right and wrong and can adequately govern his behavior to act according to that distinction. There may be sufficient evidence, however, to support a colorable argument relying on genetic and neurological evidence based on a theory of irresistible impulse. Unquote.
Mr. LeJudas.
There may be sufficient evidence, a colorable argument. That's a lot of hedging, isn't it?
Witness. It's understandable. People were bound to be skeptical about making excuses for murder. If the doctor took the stand and made that argument, she'd better be damn sure.
Mr. LeJudas.
But she did say, in fact, at least at this stage, that it was possible. It was a colorable argument.
Witness.
Yes.
Mr. LeJudas.
A murder gene?
Witness. She never used that term.
Mr. LeJudas.
Would you read the paragraph labeled Diagnosis Overview?